Welcome to the Dildorks, dorky discourse on sex, dating, and masturbating. My name is Kate Sloan. I'm a sex journalist, a sex blogger, and I have depression. Yay, fun. Who are you, friend?
I'm Billy. I'm a sex educator and porn maker, and I am depressed. But I am here for this conversation, and particularly because I adore Joellen and was not going to miss this.
Yes, we have a very special guest today who is someone we both really respect and admire. Joellen Naughty is a writer, speaker, and mental health advocate whose work explores the impact of depression on sex and relationships. We had her on once before to talk about her first book, The Monster Under the Bed, Sex, Depression, and the Conversations We Aren't Having, which, by the way, is incredible. If any part of that sounds at all relevant or interesting to you, strongly encourage checking it out. And she just released a new book, which we'll be talking about today. It's called In It Together, Navigating Depression with Partners, Friends, and Family. Hi, Joellen. So nice to be talking to you again.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to talk to both of you. It's been ages.
Yeah. I feel like the last time we saw you was maybe at ANME, which was like right before the pandemic.
I was thinking about that. And Billy, I actually tell that story because you and I hadn't seen each other in so long and you were convinced I was mad at you for some reason. And you told me the story and it was something I didn't remember. And that was it was such a powerful experience for me because I'm so frequently convinced people are super mad at me. And I think back and I'm like, just remember that because you didn't remember the thing that you know, that happened at all. So, yeah. So thank you for that.
You're welcome. That's also a very common experience for me. So like that sounds,
me too.
That sounds right. I'm definitely often have one thing where I'm like, well, can never speak to them again. I know that's fair. Couldn't possibly burden them with dealing with that.
Yeah. And you're like, I thought you were mad at me. And they're like, I thought you were mad at me. And it's just a whole thing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I wonder if you could start us off by telling us a little bit about the book and how it like relates to or builds on your previous book.
Okay. So, well, I think the important place to start is that I did not mean to write this book. I remember going out like a month before everything went into lockdown with a writer friend and them saying, so what's next? What are you going to write about? And I pitched this book that I felt so passionate about. And it was about people's careers that had been derailed by sexual harassment. And I was going to write that book. And then everything happened. And so, as you may remember, my first book was released on March 27th, 2020. So ouch. I planned an entire book tour and I announced it. And the night I announced it, the NBA shut down and Tom Hanks had COVID and like everybody was hoarding toilet paper and the world exploded. And so that meant everything was canceled. But then there was a smattering of like virtual events that happened. And over the course of those, the one thing, because I don't know about you, but I don't remember a ton about that time. But the one thing I remember is people kept saying, you know, a lot of this is advice that's good for anyone who knows someone with depression. And I kept thinking, it was such a dark time, I kept thinking, well, yeah, but they're not going to pick up the book with sex in the title. Right. And it took an embarrassing, like, a humiliating amount of time for me to be like, oh, right, I could just write a book that doesn't have the sex piece. And that is basically how we got this book. And, you know, I got to add in the things I've learned since then and the things that, you know, my own experience, because I had a whole journey since then. And so, yeah, I'm actually so excited about this book. Like my first book, I was nervous. I was thought maybe I'd get out there and you'd all be like, oh, Joellen. Not so great. This one I'm just psyched about.
Oh, that's a good feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've both been reading it. I'm really enjoying it. And I think that it is a resource that I've wanted to exist for a really long time, like something that I could hand to somebody who doesn't have any understanding of depression and be like, this is what it's like. This is what's helpful. And it's written in this way that's very like to the point and real and funny and thoughtful. And I just think it's so fantastic. This isn't a question. This is just a compliment.
Well, I appreciate it.
But you mentioned the pandemic, and I was thinking it definitely must have been very interesting to release two books about depression during a pandemic, because a lot of people are experiencing depression now, like whether for the first time or just like it's getting worse because of the conditions of the pandemic. And in the book, you talk a little bit about how in some ways it's good that people are more open to like Zoom hangouts and virtual events now. But at the same time, like even those can be really taxing on someone who's depressed. And I was wondering, like, I know that there's been, you know, scientific studies about this kind of thing and whatnot, but I was curious, like, in your 200 plus interviews that you did, like, what did you see in terms of trends regarding the pandemic? Like, how is the pandemic affecting people's depression?
Well, an important thing to remember about the interviews is only a small portion of them happened after the pandemic started. Right? So a lot of this research piggybacks off the research that made my first book happen. So in the middle of doing Monster, I noticed that we needed to be talking about the ways people could support each other and were not. And so when I started doing the interviews for Monster, at one point, those shifted. I tried to do these, like, basically Skype interviews. And as you may know, people with depression, we are not great at showing up for things. So I had 500 people sign up to do the interviews. I had 100 people take slots. And I had 20 people show up, which was brutal for me. Like, self-esteem-wise, it was awful.
But and you had to get the spoons to show up 100 times, presumably.
Yes.
Which is also, oof.
Oh, my God. Can I sidebar to tell a story that was brutal about this? Okay, so, as you may remember, as, like, 2015, this is all happening, a colleague of ours had this thing happen, Orgasm Quest, and she was going to take on her depression and orgasms, and it was, so it was sex and depression, which was great that people were talking about that. Some big outlet like BuzzFeed or something ran an article the day of my first interview, and my first interviewee stood me up and was the first commenter on that article and said, "She's changing the world by talking about sex and depression." And I was like, "You just skipped your interview for this book."
And so that laughed in face. Wow.
But anyway, so
no, that's gotta hit you right in the feels, though.
Oh my goodness,
that's rough.
Like, I understand being able to post a comment and not being able to have a long conversation about the way sex and depression is hitting you, and also to be like, no, I too am doing it, and you're actively not helping me. Is the thing you're making it harder.
I will tell you the big, like, 2020 informed shift I saw in the interviews. And I keep saying interviews, they're like essay question surveys, right? So I did them so you could answer them in your own time at home. They have questions about how you feel your race, gender, identity, like all of those things impact the treatment you receive, the support you receive, all those things. And in the original rounds, I felt like I got a lot of like, I don't know, especially from people whose, you know, identities were like white heterosexual people. The post-2020 ones, I got a lot of, well, as a white heterosexual person, I'm sure I'm getting a lot, you know, quicker attention. I'm sure there's a lot more privilege I'm experiencing. I actually saw a lot more awareness and compassion, which I, not to sound like a huge cynic, but I was kind of shocked because I was pleasantly surprised by the fact that people were getting that. It felt like the big shift I saw post 2020 was some added empathy and understanding of the differences in what we experience.
Yeah, that really feels like it has, like, shot to the forefront of the conversation during the pandemic. Like, both these discrepancies and also just the experience of mental health in general, but depression and, like, the way our mental health impacts our lives. Like, it has become way more explicit in conversations with people that weren't talking about this before. Like, it has become unignorable in pretty much everyone's life, it feels like, mm-hmm. Which has pushed, I don't know, what the, like, minimum acceptable conversation around it is, right? Like, I don't know, today, like, nowadays, I feel a lot more comfortable getting on a call and someone going, how you doing? And me going, well, I mean, I'm going, right? And, like, people are just like, oh, yeah, yeah, no, that's fair. Whereas, like, I don't know, in 2018, I probably would, oh, what's going on? What's that? You know, like, it feels like there is just more conversation around, like, some of us are having hard times and there are different ways that that can impact us, which is, I don't know, just helpful and interesting. That got rambly at the end, but here we are.
I never want to sound excited about other people's depression, but the fact that a United States senator publicly announced that he was going to get treatment for depression, like, made my heart sing, because it made it clear to me that this has kind of entered the public vernacular in a way that it hadn't even a year ago. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's powerful, because even I had a call with my college the other day, and they talked about how they have this whole system in place, and they give the students training, and they give the professors training, and they look out for each other's mental health. And when I went there, it was like, you know, Joellen cries a lot. That's weird. And if you had told me I had depression, I would have been like, no, I don't, whatever. Right. And so seeing people have that awareness and that, like, less fear around talking about it is amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's so good to be able to celebrate that, because as you point out in the book, like, a lot of people take the same attitude about it as they take about, like, student loans, where it's like, well, I had to suffer, and so you should have to suffer too, and so you should have to, like, just suck it up and, like, not, you know, admit that you have depression or seek treatment for it or talk about it. And I think we can just be nice. We can just choose to be compassionate and understanding and be happy that people younger than us are growing up in a world where it's more acceptable to talk about that stuff and to seek treatment.
Yeah. And I mean, I think any, like, the other side of this is the very mainstream conversations we have about anything tend to be, like, the really reduced versions of them, right? They don't capture the complexity of what it can look like or the nuances of what it can look like. So, like, yeah, also some of our, like, very, very public conversations around mental health look like self-care is just being cozy and having a bath with some candles and not, like, figuring out how to make sure your bills are paid so you're not stressed about them for the next few months. You know, like, we talk about, you know, and, like, or even just, like, discussions of how we should all be in therapy. Like, I feel like that's pretty common advice, right? Like, everyone should be in therapy. Okay, how is that financially accessible? Mm-hmm. How do we find therapists that are actually qualified to help us with our particular needs, right? Mm-hmm. How do we find therapists who are qualified in, like, both our mental health stuff and our social circles, right? Like, how do I find a kink-informed therapist who is, like, within my budget and within my whatever insurance, you know, all of these things. Mm-hmm. So, like, there is a lot of nuance that obviously isn't getting captured in these incredibly mainstream conversations. But the fact that mainstream conversation is using the word self-care in and of itself feels like massive growth, you know?
And yeah. I think, you know, I think there's, you watch the ripples of the conversations, right? So, like, a while back, after a highly publicized suicide, it became check in on your strong friends, the friends you think are strong, check in on them. And then after the next highly publicized suicide, it was, no, don't say that. Check in on all your friends. Everyone needs. And I wish we could correct each other and grow in these things without being, you know, such assholes about it. But I do like that we do, like, evolve together in these conversations, and we say, okay, well, we've learned that the person you think is strong maybe isn't. Okay, and now we've learned that maybe you should just check on everybody. And maybe next time we can learn, you know, like, I think it's interesting to watch this all, like, kind of get into mainstream consciousness. My partner for years was in a community that was kind of like two steps behind the community we all came from in terms of talking about, you know, whatever feelingsy thing we were talking about at the time. So I would always watch their ripples go like just behind it. And it was, it ranged from infuriating to fascinating. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy. Yeah. And I'm happy to watch it happen mental health wise. I do wish we could be kinder to each other in the moments when it's not. So there are moments we need to not be kind to each other and be like, hey, stop doing that. It's harmful. But there are moments where it's like, dude, just, you know, show them. No, check in on all your friends. And here's why.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, honestly, even in the moments when we really need to push back, as often as I still, kindness doesn't equal niceness is the thing. I can kindly call someone in on their shit and they won't necessarily feel great about it after, but like,
exactly.
I can still feel that like I did it in a kind and loving way and in a way that is like, no, you need to hear all of this. Like, I don't know what you can do with it. I don't know, but I think you can still, as often as possible, lead with kindness.
We as a society are not great at nuance. Right? So people either see it as like you're mean and harsh or you're super nice about it. And there's what my dad used to refer to my grandmother as the iron hand in the velvet glove, right? So you weren't going to mess with my grandmother, but she was going to come at you in a way where you like were like, oh, yes, of course. Now I'm listening to you. Oh, now I know I'm not going to mess with what you just said. And I like that. It's how I try to approach things. I do a lot of like, so what I think you're intending to do here is this. And I think that's great. What's actually happening is this. And that's a problem because of this. And here's what you should do instead, because I know you don't want to do this horrible thing you're actually doing right now. Please stop.
Yeah. And I think that's a really great framework for like sharing that. The other thing that's coming to mind in this like conversation around kindness is that Mia Koopa on Twitter often tweets, be brave enough to be kind, which is like a thing that, I don't know, I come back to a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
A big shift I've had in the last year or so is, okay, well, first of all, you have to understand I'm old, right? So, so I came of age in the 90s. And in the 90s, for some reason, we as a society collectively decided that it was not only cool, but like expected that we all talk to each other like complete assholes. Like,
it did do that for a while.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. And it was like the way to build your social clout. And it was a thing. And I have always been this sensitive little being that, you know, I spent my childhood being told to be less sensitive because I was crying all the time. And then I spent, you know, the 90s as a teenager being like the first person to be insulted at a party because, you know, everybody was looking for that person to insult so they could look cool and all that stuff. And I spent so much time scrambling to like cover anything that looked wrong or, you know, to get to you snarkily before you got to me and whatever. And I've realized in the last year that instead of tearing myself apart, trying to be harder to survive everything that anybody else could throw at me, what I wanted to do instead was be the best version of the sensitive little being I am and invite people to partake in that. And they can do with that what they will, but here's what it is. And life has gotten weirdly a lot easier. Because it took away all the fear. It took away all the trying to hide. And are people sometimes really mean? Yeah, but that was going on anyway. So I may as well be comfortable.
Yeah. As you were saying that, I was thinking there is, I'm sure, a balance of like, a lot of ease in that, in leaning into what comes naturally to you and feels authentic to you in your experience of the world. And there's a lot of difficulty in the vulnerability of that and in just like being able to share that with the world and be like, all right, no, what you're reacting to is like actually me, not whatever I have put out there. Cool, cool, cool. You know, so.
Yeah.
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 I don't know, that is hard, but also a good job. Kate has questions. I'm just talking. That's my segue back to Kate's professional journalism interview.
I like being the scaffolding of the conversation when we have guests. That's fun.
You're good at it.
So we were talking about reaching out to people, and that made me think about one of the points in your book that I found really fascinating, especially in the pandemic situation, which is you're talking about how people will often not reach out or offer help to someone who is visibly struggling because they feel like it's not their place or it's none of their business. And I think that this is happening even more now because the isolating conditions of the pandemic have made it so that a lot of us have sort of like doubled down on our closest connections and let our more casual ones fade. And so, you know, so that they're just on social media, or it feels like they are. And I've definitely been on both sides of this where I was like, I feel really alone that people are not reaching out and saying, I'm so sorry you're going through that. Is there anything you can do? But at the same time, I've also seen people struggling and been like, I don't feel like I should reach out because I feel like they would think it was weird because we just don't know each other that well. And like, maybe they don't even like me. And I would just sort of talk myself out of it. And so I was wondering if you have any advice on like how to navigate that situation where like you feel like you should reach out or that it could be helpful if you did, but you're not really sure if it's appropriate.
So I talk about this a couple different ways in the book because sometimes it's like legit not your place, right? Mm-hmm. And I invite people to look at like what your feelings are around what's going on for that person. Like, are you looking at what's going on for them and being like, ooh, I wonder what's going on there. I want to know the details. Cause like, if you just want the dirt, maybe don't, but if you're genuinely concerned and you feel like you don't like know them super well, or you're not super close to them, there's two things I suggest people do. One is, and this one requires some finesse, but reach out to someone who is like a mutual who is closer to them. Mm-hmm. And you can just make it simple as like, you don't have to tell me anything, like, but I'm concerned about them. Maybe check in on them and like kind of hand it off to somebody who you trust, who maybe it is more their place. The other thing is something that someone did in Portland when I lived there that was shocking to me. Because I felt like I ran into a lot of disconnection there and not a lot of the reaching out. And someone sent me a message once and it just said something like, hey, I noticed on social media you seem to be going through a lot and I know we're not very close and I'm sure you have other people you'd rather talk to. But in case you need somebody, I'm here and willing to listen or run errands or if you need anything. And again, no pressure. I understand if not, but I am here. Just wanted to let you know. And I never took them up on it, but I really did appreciate it because it was done with such like an open hand, right? They had like no ego attached to it. It just was genuinely letting me know someone cared. And I get that that's hard and scary, and you have to risk that, like, they might be like, what the hell's wrong with you? But, again, that's them. And for me, it's who do I want to have been in the world? And I want to have been the person who let someone who was struggling know someone cared.
I really love that, I think. Like, I love that it creates space for you to just not respond, because responding to messages is sometimes an astronomical amount of spoons, right? And also, like, it recognizes that you have people, like, you probably have people that you could be talking to. Like, I recognize I'm not the first person you would come to talk about this, because we're not that close. Like, it recognizes their place. And also, like, it recognizes that, frankly, sometimes I need someone I'm not that close. Like, sometimes I'm dealing with issues that are affecting very much my inner circle, and someone who doesn't know any of those people would be actually really convenient to talk to about this, you know? Or like, you know, someone who I don't feel a ton of social pressure around because they're not someone I'm super close to, right? Like, sometimes someone at a little bit of a distance can be particularly helpful. But, like, I don't know, at the same time, I've tweeted a couple things in my feels recently and was like, yeah, I'm taking some time offline for a second. And I have a couple of, like, just you okays in my DMs from people I have never met in person. Mm-hmm. Like, that ain't... No, the answer is no. What, like, and is that going to make you feel better when I reply that? Like, you know, so I like that that message helps without putting, like, an additional chore on your to-do list, basically.
Yeah. Yep. And I found it helpful as the person sending that type of message to explicitly say no reply needed. Mm-hmm. Not only for them so that they have that pressure alleviated, but also for me so that I don't start to be like, are they mad at me? Do they hate me? Are they annoyed that I even sent that message? Because I already gave myself and them permission for them not to reply by saying that.
Absolutely.
Another section of the book that I wanted to talk to you about was the part about just do it. And this was something that came up in The Monster Under the Bed as well. It was the common advice for depressed people who are not maybe having as much sex as they want to be having to just do it. And you were really vocally against that advice. And it was interesting to see you in this book expanding that to cover areas of life beyond just sex. And I wondered if you could talk us through that. Like, how did you come to the conclusion that just do it is bad advice, and why do you think it's bad advice?
The day that it dawned on me that like applied beyond sex, it's one of those things where I'm still shocked it like took so long, and it was like a light switch went on. But it was honestly looking back over like a billion little memories and things that aren't even important. My partner and I once had a weird fight over the fact that he really wanted me to check out this one show, and I was injured and I was in a lot of pain and I was waiting for surgery and I was miserable all the time. And I kept saying, no, I don't want to look at something new. I don't want to know. And one day he just walked in and he was like, you know what? I'm going to put it on right now. And I kind of lost it. And I said, fucking no. I said no to you. And what I realized when that popped into my head during this is whenever we tell people, when you know, even if you really don't want to do it, just do it because you'll feel better anyway. There's always that risk that you won't feel better anyway. And the lesson you've taken away from that is it's more important to not listen to you and do this, like, things society deems important in that moment. And when you have depression, you don't need another voice telling you that what you're feeling is not important. And listen, I know that one of the big problems with depression is it tells you everything is super hard and you shouldn't do it. But it's why the, because another idea I pulled over from sex into the rest of life here is the idea of conscious decisions, right? So is it, you know, I don't want to walk the dog because, good God, please don't make me. I just can't. Or is it walking the dog sounds kind of hard and, you know, his leash is all the way over there and whatever. Because if it's the second one, you know what, maybe we take it a step at a time and we say, you know, I only have to walk him down to the end of the block. And then we, you know, see where we get with it. And the dog gets walked. If it's the one that's, oh, please, dear God, no, don't make me. Maybe we call the dog walker that day because, again, there's nuance in it. There's the thing where you're overriding your brain screaming, please don't make me do this, versus the thing where you're negotiating with your brain that's trying to tell you, you know, that's super duper hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that some of the most helpful support I've received during really bad depressive episodes has been from my partner asking, okay, like, you feel like you can't do this thing, whether it's feeding yourself or doing this errand you need to do or, like, getting outside for 5 minutes or whatever. Like, why do you feel like you can't do it? Because a lot of times if I'm having that overwhelming, depressive feeling of like, I can't, I might not have examined it very closely to think about why is it that I can't. And as you said, sometimes it is just an overwhelming, like, I can't. And it's mostly just like, because being in bed is what I'm doing right now. And it's all I can manage right now. But sometimes it is something so practical, like I don't know what to wear if I go outside, mm-hmm. or I am having money anxiety, so I don't feel like I can order food. And if it's something specific like that, then a partner or friend or somebody may be able to help you with that. But also even just the act of identifying that sometimes is helpful for me, because then I can go, oh, that's actually smaller than it felt like it was. And even if it takes me, you know, five times as long, I'm probably still going to eventually be able to pick out an outfit to wear outside, and then I'll be able to actually go outside.
Yeah, a weird thing that comes up, like, more than one would expect in a book about depression, in It Together, is the DMV. Because, in my opinion, one of the absolute best ways to support me when I'm struggling is to come with me on an errand I don't want to run. Mm-hmm. And when I moved back to Jersey, my cousin Mike just volunteered to go with me to the DMV to get my new license. And that was, like, it didn't even occur to me that I needed that, but I desperately needed that. And when I had been in Portland, I would like stockpile my errands, the post office and, you know, whatever I had to, because I felt like on my own, I couldn't. But if my partner was there, it was suddenly like a fun little outing where we could get a cup of coffee and, you know, so I think there's ways to attack it that make it feel a little different. And then there's some days where you really just can't, and that's okay too.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I was grappling with if I had things to add, because this, frankly, I'm having issues parsing which of my issues, like, I have these same struggles when I'm not in the depths of depressive episodes, because I just struggle with executive functioning and ADHD.
Right.
So, like, listening to y'all talk about that, I was just kind of sitting with and parsing, like, I don't know, trying to think about the ways in which that does feel different when, like, the issue is, no, I can't eat, because if I gotta eat, I gotta decide where I'm getting food from, and then I gotta go to a grocery store, and then I gotta assemble the food, but first I gotta pick a recipe, and then, oh, does the grocery store have those things? And, like, I can't eat because there are so many questions and I am lost in all of the questions and I can't find where the first decision starts and make the decisions in order is like, can happen on any day and can be fixed with a list. Mm-hmm. And when depression is also a factor there, there is definitely like the brain fogginess that just like feels like going through that process, but through quicksand, right? In a way that's like, hey, I have all these struggles and I'm wearing Goku's like weighted training outfit. I'm not usually the anime metaphor person, but here we are, right? Like, I'm trying to do it with all this extra struggle. And like, there is also just this haze of just like, no, I simply can't because I can't. Not, yeah. you could put the list in front of me, and I'm like, yeah, but that just sounds so hard, and I have literally no desire to, like, which is, you know, definitely coexists with the executive functioning, but does also feel distinct, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I feel like every time I talk in public about this stuff, a thing that comes up is how much overlap there is in when people have ADHD or when they have chronic health conditions or, you know, when they've experienced trauma. There are different things that lead to a lot of the same things that come with the depression package. And a lot of the questions I field are like, do you deal with them in the same way? And this is where my whole not a doctor, not a therapist thing comes up, because I don't feel comfortable saying yes, absolutely. Because I don't know for sure. I feel comfortable saying, you know, try it with depression because that's what I have experience with. But I, you know, I don't want to. I kind of want to be like, maybe try it, but I don't want to. You know, I don't want to be Dr. Oz about it. You know, I don't want to be selling people crap.
Yeah.
Well, and that makes sense. And like, part of what I was thinking about is with the Just Do It, which like, with 88, if my issue is the executive functioning is simply parsing through getting to do the thing. Someone putting the thing in front of me and starting me doing the thing is sometimes the answer. And with that depressive – and with, like, the depression skin on top of that, it is much more likely not to be the answer, which was also, like, an interesting thing because I was like, no, sometimes I really do just need to just do it. But that is when I am lost in this feeling of, like, oh, I can't do it because I truly can't fathom what it would look like to do it. I can't imagine the feeling or the image of doing it. I can't picture it in my head, which makes it feel impossible. And that I have come to recognize as much more a symptom of ADHD than the, like, fog of lack of motivation and inability to, like, it feels like, you know those old Claritin commercials, Claritin Clear?
Yeah.
Feels like there is that fog between me and the version of me that's up in my head being like, hey, we care about these things. We have all of this time that we could be spending on, look, I have all of these ideas. Would you like to do them? And the depression's just like, nah, we simply can't. So, yeah, they feel like different tones of similar things, and there is definitely overlap in what I need, but there's also difference in what I need in those options, in those experiences. Mm-hmm. I lost the thread. Anyway.
It's all right. We got you. As I was reading about the interviews that you did for the book, I was thinking about something I read recently in a different book, Laziness Does Not Exist. Mm-hmm. And the author, Devin Price, was talking about how when he was doing all these interviews with people, a lot of them were very draining emotionally because there was a lot of heavy emotional content, and sometimes he was letting them drag on for like longer than an hour, and he was just finding he was really emotionally depleted from doing these interviews, and so he ended up having to sort of adjust his boundaries around them in order to like preserve his own mental health. And it was making me wonder, like, did you take measures to take care of your own mental health as you were reviewing these survey responses or as you were working on the book? Because I imagine that it doesn't necessarily exactly help with the depression to be thinking about it and writing about it all the time. But then again, I also know sometimes it can help. So how did you approach that?
So the first thing I did was almost completely break my brain when I got the responses to the survey I did before Monster, which had 1,100 responses, right? And I put them all in this bound book, and I like read them obsessively, and I loved all that information. And then I did those 20 Skype interviews, and I transcribed them, and that was a lot. Mm-hmm. And eventually I spoke to Stephen Biggs, the psychotherapist from Toronto, who helped me kind of stay on the path with all this stuff, and he basically said, yeah, that's a lot, stop doing that. And so the way I did the rest of the interviews, that like kind of essay question survey format, was great because it allowed me to export them into spreadsheets. And the spreadsheets are searchable. So I could do neat stuff, like say, like, today I want to think about this idea, and go through and read the different responses, and then say, okay, this response was interesting. What else is going on in this person's column? I could basically, like, do little, like, bite-sized pieces of it instead of just diving in completely. And it was so much better. And I learned over time that there were kind of like with Monster, I learned that there were parts of that survey that just ended up being completely irrelevant to the book. I learned that there were parts of the interviews that maybe they did pop up in the book, but I couldn't spend too much time diving too deep on the answers because it was too much for me. But let me tell you, the spreadsheet saved my life.
Yeah. That makes sense. And I imagine it is also a good way to just notice like trends and broader picture things rather than sitting in one individual life for the time it takes you to go through all of these essay questions, right?
Exactly.
You're looking at the way like lots of people are experiencing things.
And what was great was the way columns, you know, happen in spreadsheets. Mm-hmm. I could go down like, you know, the question like, what was the worst support, you know, attempt at support you ever received? And I could read down them and it would be like reading like a Reddit thread, right? Instead of going through somebody's whole depression experience and then getting to that, you got to bop around. Mm-hmm. So I could see the lady whose family dropped off an entire Thanksgiving dinner at her house unannounced. And that was interesting. But then you go to the lady whose mother told her depression didn't exist. And, you know, so it ups and downs. But it was a much more brain-friendly way to consume it.
Mm-hmm. That's smart.
Yeah.
I want to move on to some of the questions we got from listeners. And actually, the first one plays really nicely into what you just said about the Thanksgiving dinner. This listener was wondering, is it good to do nice things for a depressed person unprompted, such as bringing them breakfast in bed? Or will that just make them feel like they can't take care of themselves?
So this is going to vary person to person. So there's two big sections in the book that kind of come at this. One is a section where I actually I talk a lot about doing the things that actually help that person rather than doing the things that make you feel like a good helper.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So and for that section, I go into love languages, which I know not everybody loves. But for me, it was a great piece of language to kind of parse what works for people. Because for me, it's acts of service. My cousin Mike is a really great guy. Him picking up my car and changing out my brakes one day was the amazing thing I needed done in my life. If he had instead spent a bunch of money on gifts for me, that wouldn't have been as helpful, right? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a bit about knowing the person. It's a bit about knowing kind of how much they're open to. Also, though, it's a bit in the delivery, right? So if it's, I brought you this breakfast because I know there's no way you're going to feed yourself, you useless sack of shit. You know, that's not going to help. But if it's, you know, I sent you this because I know you love the donuts from this place or whatever, that's a different feeling. The other part of the book that is kind of my favorite is the last chapter. Chapter 10 is called The Cheat Sheet. And it ended up being the longest chapter of the book, but literally all it is, if you buy the book and you don't feel like reading the entire thing before you can help someone, flip back to chapter 10. And there are things you can say to your depressed friend and things you really don't want to say to them and texts you can send and things you can do that are helpful and, you know, things that aren't helpful. So it's like kind of an easy way to get some ideas of things that would be helpful rather than the steamrolling, as it were. Yeah. So I guess the question about whether to bring them breakfast kind of depends on them. And
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think what you said about delivery is really important. But I also like want to come back to what you said about love languages, because yeah, I mean, the book they came from and the people have their feelings about it. But and also, I find it to be a useful tool or even just mental framework for thinking about this. Like, even if you look at the list of the five love languages that What's-His-Face wrote about, and don't see yourself on there, but you're like, my love language is sending memes, you know, my love language is, right? Like, it is still a way of thinking about the way we give and receive love and a way of talking about it to be like, no, what actually helps me feel loved in this moment and what would help me feel cared for and how can I, like, articulate that to you, you know what I mean? And I think that's a really valuable conversation to have here. And I also like what you said about, like, not just delivery, but I don't know, I got you these donuts because I know you like this place. Like,
yeah,
I don't know, if you're getting someone, even if you're getting them breakfast because you know they're not good at feeding themselves and they haven't eaten in a, you know, had a good breakfast in a couple days or whatever, like, you can still make it look like you're just doing a nice thing for them, right? You don't have to be like, here are your protein supplements so that you have, because you're not eating. Here you go. Like, yeah. You're like, no, here is a delightful thing that would be a nice treat to send literally anyone, mm-hmm. but also happens to serve this need that you have right now. So it can feel less like you're getting it just because you're a worthless sack of shit who couldn't do it on your own, or whatever narrative your brain gives you.
Yes, mm-hmm. The night I found out that the great doctor who I had just found, who gave me a small amount of hope that I might be able to stay in Portland, his clinic got its funding pulled and was shutting down. The night I found that out, my best friend sent me an order from a service called GoPuff. And mm-hmm. it was this enormous bag of snacks, but it was literally everything she'd ever heard me say I liked. And so it was this like walking tour of the favorite snacks of my life. And so it felt so incredibly thoughtful to be like, oh my goodness, I mentioned how much I loved Sour Patch Kids in seventh grade. And like, it was, it was so sweet. And whereas it could, like, if she had just been like, I don't know, here's a bunch of ice cream because you're sad, that might have felt different. But it was so thoughtfully done that I still think about it all the time.
Yeah. Like, I don't know. If you're getting someone a gift because they're sad, you can still treat it like any other gift you would get them. And mm-hmm. it can still be a fun fucking gift. I don't know. You know, like,
yeah.
You can still get something that would be delightful to receive, even if I'm receiving it because I kind of need it right now.
Yeah. Yep. Another listener question. This is interesting and has come up for me a lot of times. Under what circumstances, if any, should you postpone having difficult conversations with a depressed partner? And this person specified conversations that are unrelated to their depression, mm-hmm. Until they're in a better place mentally. And I've especially heard people talk about this in reference to like breakups, like, yeah. you know, if your partner's mm-hmm. actively going through a hard depressive spell, you shouldn't break up with them. And like, I don't really know how I feel about that advice. I think that that has the capacity to go really badly, but I also think it can be kind in some circumstances. I don't know. What do you think?
I struggle with this one too, because I feel like I would never want to be in a horrific depressive episode and realize, even after the fact, that someone was miserable and stayed with me, like, because it would have been bad to leave then. Mm-hmm. But also, I know what it feels like to be in a horrific depressive episode, and I can't imagine somebody breaking up with me during that. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to be really honest, folks. I don't know the answer to this. I hope at some point in my career to identify an answer to this, but I also don't know if there is a single answer to this. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think this might be a case-by-case basis. You know, if you are in a relationship with somebody who you know has a super supportive family or an amazing friend group or all these people around them that can hold them up, and mm-hmm. so you can say to those people, I need to break up. You know, this is happening. Please support them. That can maybe happen really successfully. Mm-hmm. If this mm-hmm. person is completely on their own and has no one else, and you know, that could maybe be disastrous. I don't, like, there's so many factors, and I don't actually have the answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think especially, like, when we're thinking particularly about the breakup conversation here, too, it's like the question is of like, what does their support network look like? Questions of like, frankly, the nature of the depressive episode. Is this like a peak of a really short one? Or is this an ongoing depressive episode for a couple years now that they're like living in and is just kind of their reality? Because mm-hmm. you really can't put off life for a couple years, like every aspect of life. Mm-hmm. If this, like, because you're experiencing this, right? Like, so I think, I don't know, looking at, like, the severity of that and also looking at the reasons you're breaking up. Like, mm-hmm. are you breaking up because, like, you're growing apart and, like, you still have a lot of love for each other, but this doesn't feel like it's going where you necessarily want it to? Because, mm-hmm. like, yeah, maybe you can stay with someone with a lot of love and empathy for a little longer than you would have planned to because they're going through a thing. But like, do you need to leave because you're feeling unsafe in the relationship, or because you're fighting all the time, or because, like, I don't know, maybe your presence there is, like, not helping this depressive episode, right? Mm-hmm. Rather than abandoning them, could leave them more space to work on things in their own way, right? Like, there is so much complexity and, like, individuality that goes into this that I think, especially the question of the breakup, is, like, a really challenging one. Mm-hmm. But I do want to scale back a little bit to just the question of, like, difficult conversations. Like, because a breakup is a thing that, like, happens probably once, right? And you decide when you're timing that, right? Mm-hmm. But, like, I need to talk about the state of my relationship during my relationship. I need to talk about that thing you said that hurt my feelings that, like, probably has nothing to do with this depressive episode. Like, obviously, hurt feelings can be a result of all, but, like, also other things are happening in our shared reality that we need to talk about. So, like, what about conversations like that, where it's like, we got to talk about some heavy things, but, like, you're also always dealing with some heavy things.
So I have a couple of sets of feelings here, and it all depends on the circumstance, right? So one thing I want to just tack on to the breakup conversation, because it comes up in both books and it's so important. Not everyone can be in a relationship with someone who has depression. Not everyone is cut out for it. If you are somebody who worries a lot that things will not be fair, things will not be even, if you think it's a question of mind over matter and they can, you know, I don't know, positive their way out of it. There are situations in which staying has the potential to do more damage than leaving ever could. And if you are someone who is not cut out to be in a relationship with someone with depression, breaking off that relationship is a kindness. And I think there's a lot of stigma around it, but I think doing that rather than staying and making life worse is the choice to take. Now,
I also, Go ahead. Briefly.
Yeah.
No, building on what you said, like, I do also think, like, yes, if you are a person who believes someone can positive their way out of it or has, like, you know, a lot of those things feel like beliefs around depression that, like, frankly, you could work on and maybe show up better for them as well, right? Like, if that is the thing, if you're not interested in doing that, you're not interested in doing that. But, like, also, you could not have the capacity to support someone because you don't have, like, you are struggling on your own, or you are struggling with depression or any number of other mental health things, or, like, you can want to have the capacity and you can have the empathy for it, and you can also not have the practical time or not have the spoons for yourself or any number of other things.
Yeah.
So, like,
yeah, it's true.
The math can just be that you don't have it even if you want to.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But also, I want to talk about, like, conversations and things. I cut you off.
Okay, so this gets tricky. So because sometimes the difficult conversation we want to have is about something, like, let's say your partner who has depression said something, like, mean to you and and was disrespectful, and you need to talk to them about that. That needs to be addressed, right? Now, let's say your partner with depression has decided to set boundaries and you don't like that. That is different. And that is something you might have feelings that you need to work on, right? But you shouldn't be working on them with that partner, right? So this is where I talk a lot about something called ring theory.
Love this.
So it envisions everybody in whatever situation it is, sickness, depression, trauma, whatever, in a series of concentric circles. So the person who the thing is happening to is at the center, and then, you know, their closest people, the next circle out, and then the, you know, so on and so on, moving away. And you send comfort in and you dump out. Okay, so if your partner has set a boundary and that boundary, you don't like it, but the boundary is not, you know, cruel or unfair or whatever, it's just new and you are struggling with it, that's a time you need to turn to an outer ring and talk to them about it. Now, a thing that where ring theory goes wrong is it does not mean that you cannot, like, if you have a rough day at work, this doesn't mean you can't come home and tell your depressed partner or friend, like, man, work was rough today. Like, you're not, you don't only have to have fluffy, comforting conversations with them. Because, like, you know, you're still their friend or partner or whatever. And so it's important to maintain that balance, right? So comfort in dumping the feelings about the situation out, but also still having, you know, your normal conversations with them.
So if I have, like, a difficult conversation about the relationship that I do need to have with that partner, how do I time it? Like, how do I choose when?
Yeah.
You know, you run into the, like, do I ruin a good day or do I make a bad day worse? Right.
Right. And do I spring it on them or do I, like, build all this anxiety by saying, like, we need to have a talk later? Like,
yeah,
there's all of these things. So a thing I've started doing, and I don't advise this in this situation, but I think there's a way to adapt it. I have a friend who had a boss who was very, very mean and emotionally abusive. And so they're incredibly sensitive now to any kind of, like, we need to talk or any kind of, like, correction. So now whenever they do, like, if they do something that I need them to stop doing because it has impacted me badly or whatever, I send them a Marco Polo where I say, okay, like, because they can see me smiling and they can see me saying, like, listen, I don't hate you. I'm not angry. It's just when you do this, this happens. And so that's a problem, right? So I think it's less about the timing and more about the delivery. And I'm not saying you need to be, you know, happy, peppy, smiley about it. But I think a lot of times we treat these conversations like they are necessarily doom and gloom. When really it can be like, let's talk about the state of our relationship because we want to be on the same page and we want to be happy in it. So let's talk about that. I think, honestly, I think the key thing here is kind of demystifying those conversations because that takes away the fear of ruining a good day or making a bad day worse or scaring them or whatever.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And my partner will always say a lot of, like, I'm not mad. You're not in trouble. Like, this is just something we need to talk about. And I'll say for myself, like, when having these difficult conversations when depressed, like, it's really important for me to be able to take them very slowly and sometimes be like, I need to take a break for 15 minutes to regulate my emotions a bit. And then also sometimes be like, I need to take a break. Can we revisit this, like, on Thursday? And that can be helpful for me.
I really, I can't endorse enough the practice of taking breaks, like just when we need to feel things, right? So a thing I don't like about myself is that sometimes I like lose my patience intensely and I feel like I'm super angry and then I'm super embarrassed by it later. So I was staying with a friend a couple weeks ago and his building kept shutting the power off. And I had all of this work planned and all of these Zoom calls, and I was going to do it while he was at work. And he came to me in the morning and he said, they're shutting the power off all day today. You can come to work and use my office. And luckily, my dog was agitating to be fed. And I said, listen, I need to feed the dog. And I went into the kitchen and I'm feeding the dog. And the whole time I'm going, what the fuck is this bullshit? Why are we constantly shutting off the power? And I'm just like ranting and raving. And then by the time I fed the dog, I was like, oh, but if I worked out of the office, I'd have like a nice background for my Zooms and I could walk the dog around there. And I, and like by the time that was all done, I had kind of had my angry moment and processed the whole thing. And I could come back to him and be okay with it and not have that thing where I was embarrassed because I like snapped at my friend for no reason. And I've started applying this in like so many situations. Like if I feel myself kind of, you know, getting upset in a conversation, I'll say like, I need a moment to kind of integrate this into like my brain in a way I can deal with. And then I can come back and use it productively. I don't know why we don't talk about this more. People, take breaks in your conversations.
It's huge. It's absolutely a game changer. Yep.
Yeah, I absolutely need a degree. What that story reminded for me is I absolutely need a degree of, like, processing time on sudden changes of plans and things. And it is a thing I have recognized as probably a part of the autism, but I definitely have a, like, tipping point of where I will run out, like, there are a limited number of changes to plans that I can handle, and then I hit what the literature calls a meltdown. I have always called blue screening, because I feel like a computer that just stops, it's just blue screens. And, like, in those moments, I definitely need to, like, take a little while to just sit in that, and, like, again, my brain will come around to, like, no, there are totally fine things in this new plan. This new plan is totally doable. And I'm like, no, but I hate it because it's new.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for joining us, Joellen. It was really fascinating to talk with you. And thank you for sharing your wisdom and experiences. Before we wrap up, can you tell our listeners where they can find you online and any info you want to share about where they can get the book?
Absolutely. You can find me online at redheadbedhead.com and on social media for the time being. I'm Joellen Naughty, that's my full name, on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And you can get the book at redheadbedhead.com/books. Also, though, this one is kind of everywhere. I'd like to say anywhere books are sold. We've got the paperback, the ebook, and the audiobook, which is read by me. So if you've enjoyed my voice, go pick that one up.
Awesome. Thank you. I'm Kate Sloan. I'm at girlyjuice.net. I'm girly_juice on Instagram and Twitter. I have two books also. You can find those by Googling me. Where is your stuff, Brent?
I'm Billy Lore. You can find all my porn and information about my workshops at billylore.com. I'm also at Billy Lore on Twitter and Instagram. Together we're the Dildorks. We're at thedildorks.com and at thedildorks on Twitter and Instagram. If you go to patreon.com/thedildorks, you can throw a couple of bucks our way. And if you throw $6 a month at us, you get access to our exclusive Discord. And for $12 a month, you get our Patreon-only bonus episodes where we share some wild stories sometime. I just say some shit over there. You should come hang out.
Thank you to our top-tier Patreon supporters, Nat, Argo, Amy, Amelia, Stabitha, Christie, and MB. We really appreciate the support. Thank you to Protodome for our theme song. Thank you to Amy for our logo. Thank you to our wonderful guest, Joellen Naughty. And thank you to you for listening. Until next time, folks, get out there and live your sexy, dorky life. Bye. Yay, thank you. That was so fun. I want you in the morning. And yeah, I think that that's about it. Did you have any questions for us before we hop in?
No, I did want to give you a heads up that my dog is in the room. So he's usually pretty good with this stuff, but just in case he decides he has feelings about things.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good to know.
To be fair, all of Philadelphia is outside my window, so I might be giving you a run for your money and background noise here.
Nice.
We're doing the best we can. I'm Billy Lore. You can find all my porn and take that one. I know where I am. I know who I am. It's fine.
I feel like I know that in theory there's a part of the population that's not depressed, but I don't know who those people are. Like, I feel like I don't know any of them.